Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight, Travis will be speaking, and the topic is populism.
So this is really wonderful to be able to talk with you tonight. I talked last year, late last fall, about freedom, and this is the last talk in a series that included that, and an earlier talk in this year on siblingship. So I took inspiration from the French motto of liberty, equality, and fraternity. And so substituting liberty for the more general freedom and fraternity with the gender inclusive siblingship. And so for this talk, I'm substituting equality with populism, and which is the opposite of elitism. You will, of course, be familiar with talk of the elite, and material elitism is only part of that landscape. So these are people with decisions to make for society, for broadly with the rest of us, and we rely on this. And so elites are often either depicted as in many ways, so either rich or greedy or clever, sometimes heartless, but these are people who tend to spend time thinking about systems, because that's systems are the only way in which they can have influence on that scale. And it's not actually so binary, but you can't have elite without populace. But what is a populist? Populist is someone who is working to expand plurality within society. And sometimes I'll use the more narrow term pluralist. And the reason we talk so much about elites these days is that many of our human systems are unequal, and disturbingly so at times. And I'm not going to talk about political parties tonight. I'm not going to talk too much about the election, but I thought, well, if I could talk about populism now, it'd be a good timing for what's going on. My wife, Rhea, is very direct about how she feels about this subject. She comes from what she refers to as a dog-eat-dog background. And her place in America as a privileged position in the world means a lot to her. And even to call it America, you know, is a privilege. And of course, it's the United States. She was very scared of our dog at first. And, you know, if you go to the Philippines, they have a much different attitude, much different than how he looks over there, you know, right now. They're very skittish. They're scared of you. And so her early feelings, as she's related them to me, were of uncertainty about the world, and strong feelings of insecurity. And even now, those early experiences mean that it takes more for her to feel safe or to feel like she has enough. And she has a view of feeling in some ways excluded from opportunities in the world. We all know of a materially secure person who left a role in society, an enviable role in society. The story goes that 2,000 years ago, there was a prince of a kingdom in India who saw some realities of life that led him to the conclusion that he wasn't living a complete life. He ventured out to understand what was missing, spent years in that effort. Eventually, there was a shift in his understanding about his life. And he spent the rest of his life with people, teaching and helping others gain this understanding in their lives. Social dynamism, or that dynamic of what I just described, requires freedom. This kind of freedom is something our society needs. To have it more broadly is populism. You know, our deepest freedom or potential actually comes from our birth in the world. And the freedom to create and to act in plurality with others is a deeper, truer freedom than, you know, freedom of choice or something like that. To be, to do, or to not be here or not do this, if you want to create something big, i.e. a system, or act in a way that's lasting, you have to have some dedication to it, which might imply the exclusion of something else that you wanted to do. But when it requires the exclusion of someone else, I think that's the issue. So freedom is not a status like citizenship. It's what you do and how it compares to what you're capable of. And we tend to, as I said, to focus on these specific freedoms like freedom of speech, freedom of choice, freedom of religion. Buddhism allows the freedom to continue to form beliefs and to be free enough to accept or surrender responsibility. You can be free enough to accept criticism mindfully, to share an idea. You can be free enough to be engaged in organizations with flaws and imperfections, which is all organizations. You know, and if you think about what an effective leader is, it's someone who can make decisions in these systems. And even, I rarely use this word, but I'll use it here, is even wield justice. That's in the realm of what leaders do, and they have to have the support to do that. And I say that because allying yourself to a benevolent and effective leader can often feel good. It can feel safe. It can feel stable. And there are even dynasties, you know, families that created or create an unbroken lineage of rule across generations. And if we compare that to democracy, it doesn't always feel as good. It can be messy. So with that need for stability, we also have this urge for change. We have an urge or call towards collective action. And democracies require assemblies. Assemblies are, by their nature, partial. They limit to how large they can scale. They're often competitive. It's natural for people within them to think of their group. And no one's immune from exclusion. We're good at sensing when that happens, whether it's being part of someone else's story about us or just not being seen. Vanessa recently told me a story about the start of her Zen practice. She made a second visit to this monastery in France. I think this was 20 years ago now. And a nun there said to her when she returned, "Little girls who wear bangles and paint their nails don't tend to come back for a second round." And when I started at Canada, there was a person who said, "Why would someone like you ever be interested in Zen?" Or I would talk about my childhood and say, and he would say, "Stop, you're bragging. You're bragging." And we can even silently do that to ourselves. And I think that as our society becomes more complicated, complex, people are under this pressure, this selection pressure. They're being sorted out earlier and more aggressively for their suitability within a system. You know, certain tasks are sourced globally. You know, and critical to the success of the teams that work on these tasks. Multiculturalism is a code for something far more practical: social acceptance, tolerance, and inclusivity through this process of imagining that goal. So, on the other hand, what's actually happening with this incessant sorting is social structures that are exclusive. And how do we engage with that? You know, I think about Les's question about technology needing a partner. I think we are the partners in this. And whether we're talking about human systems, that's not the point. We are the partners of human systems. We're the partners of digital systems. You are the only partner you can provide. And they can be natural systems too. Whether you have enough training isn't the point. And the only decision, the choice we have is to put ourselves into it. So this is the plural populist attitude. And in Buddhist tradition, it's sometimes called the marketplace. But we have to make choices about how we're going to best partner with the world. And it could be, it's easy to be overwhelmed by it. Many people, and myself included, struggle with this attitude that you can't teach me anything. You know, there's this hit song last year called Old Town Road. And in the main line in it, and there's lots of songs like this, but the main refrain in it is, "Ain't nobody tell me nothing." And that's okay. But this was a hit song. I mean, it broke records for consecutive weeks at number one. The thing that made that song go and have the success that it had was that it showed a future where people could be together. A popular America that would be united, despite being aware that we have deep divisions. I could get in, as I have before, into more of the analysis of the song. But it's a song it's very sweet, and it has a freedom to it, and it sees restrictions, but that we live in a sense in different worlds, but in the same world as well. That even if the attitude could be like, "You don't care, or you're not engaged in my world," which is the realest thing I know. If I share it with you, we have more of a collective overlap in our realities. And you know, we would live in a better world if we had that attitude. But it's easy to see that the attitude can often be that, you know, this group is in my way. I would live in a better world if people like you weren't taking everything. And this is a breakdown of community. And it's even broken down to the dialogue to the extent that we sometimes even lack for a common ground for dialogue, which is really important, you know, to be able to have a dialogue. That communal orientation, our development and drive from dependence to independence as we mature, and our reliance on our abstract intellect means that we have this predilection for, you know, saviors. And you know, the religious parables are like the one I shared, are by definition populist. And we could go back through US presidents, and there'd be presidents like Jackson or Lincoln or even Robert Kennedy. And you could see how, you know, notions of populism have expanded as our world shrank. True populism today includes everyone. I think, you know, the extent of the other, which could be, you could think of it as the excluded, I think is the issue. The other thing I wanted to propose is that the world is it's not increasingly controlled by elite people, but rather by algorithms, non-human entities, conscious but non-human digital systems. And these algorithms do not prioritize the diverse world of humanity, but instead have a set of solutions. Now, that solution set varies, and it's a whole nother domain, but I can see how it approximates reality, but how it creates divisiveness as well. And there's varying degrees of optimism with these systems and their ability to, you know, adequately create and maintain the world. There are some within our Sangha that disagree with me about this. It's closely related to, you know, how optimistic you are about science and rationalism. It has its place, but it's limited. And I think it deserves mention. We have to be very careful with the amount of control we give to digital systems. And many of the most ambitious of us are now spending their time learning more than the next person about those systems, about those algorithms. That does not qualify them to describe what reality is. And that's a real issue, I think. And, you know, much of the world's current unrest is around this dispossession and the limits of that technocratic control. So we're kind of in a cultural stasis because of the dependency on technology and not knowing how our human systems yet need to evolve. Work. Work ties us to the world. It's a worldliness, and our efforts and labors tie us to the human condition. So when we look at the Eightfold Path, you know, you have right livelihood. And this is commonly thought of as the work that we do. Who does it benefit? Are the benefits truly there? But we can take a role in creating order in our lives. And this is this is part of right understanding for ourselves. But Zen traditions alone don't create a complete way of life for our world. We have to adapt it. And that world has been destroyed by modernity. It's increasingly fractured by the technological changes that we see accelerating. And yet there's an urge to create something new, something broader than our understanding. That's our task. Any effort in that direction starts with our sincerity. And this practice is a means of developing that foundation. And so our tradition can help us. And it's a treasure in that sense. Now, there are others that struggle to maintain order in their lives. We all struggle, but there are people that struggle to take care of themselves. And we also have to take care of that aspect of society. If there are too many people that need help and not enough help, needs go unanswered. And we struggle as broadly as society. So then people fight and yell about their values, and those that are included in their favorite groups. But when humans act together, they are more powerful than any individual organism, any force on the planet. It's obvious, right? We're still subject to the laws of nature, but that power is derived from our unique ability to imagine an abstract goal in the future, collectively believe in it, and take action to achieve that goal. And that's where, the importance of dialogue comes in as well. When dialogue breaks down, when people lose a common vision, we lose our ability to be in a functional society. I don't think wanting more for society is a problem if you understand the true cost, but often we don't. We should act to understand and exist in the natural world for the generations to come. And our understanding, our scientific understanding, can aid us with this if we're sincere enough to look at it. And it includes, that right action includes all humanity and all life. There's really nothing more that we have to do. There's much within that, but there's nothing more we have to do than that. The day after the November election in 2016, I walked out of Starbucks with Brenda, and we were talking outside, and I remember, she was very stunned by the election. But before we jumped in our cars, we agreed that whatever happened, we were going to learn something in the next 4 years. I would suggest that right action is increasingly important today with our practice and to take our places in the world. Right action requires both freedom and pluralism. And we can be part of a more engaged Buddhism. I think we're situated well to make that happen, to create something new. So I think I'll open up for questions now. I'm interested in how you think of values, both your personal values and values as they relate to society.
Vanessa?
Thank you, Travis. I have a question. At the end there, you were just, you were talking about moving towards a more engaged Buddhism. I'm curious, like, what, how you see that, like, how you would describe that, like, what you would envision, as a more engaged Buddhism, and does it differ from what is currently known as engaged Buddhism and socially active Buddhism, especially for us here locally?
Well, if I start with, you know, our Zendo, sometimes we go back to this sacred space that that we have, and Les has referred to it as a training ground, and values like internal values, intrinsic values like discipline and mindfulness and equanimity, that certain consistency that gets you out of bed and onto the cushion, that's the start. But there's a point where, you look at, right action, which, you have right effort. You know, we have to make an effort just to live in the world. Like, I should, take care of my diet. I should, make sure that, the family is taken care of. It's labor just to exist in the world. And then to be at work, is part of right livelihood. Have to like create something valuable for society. You have to, practice, these intrinsic values in the world. So what I mean by right action and bringing it out in more of an engaged way is, when we are solid with each other as a Sangha, and we also value each other's ideas, we value our uniqueness, and we're committed together as a group. I think we talk about charitable giving. We have a range of opinions about that, but in the end, I think we're set up to both give, not just money, but to give time and effort towards less fortunate people. And I would love to be part of a future where, that is, how we grow as an organization. Because as I said, one person can only do so much, but, we have so many talented people. And I think, the coordinated effort of a group, that's as passionate as ours, could be really, impactful.
Hi, Travis.
Hi, Teresa.
I'll ask a question. We had a speaker on Saturday for the Buddhism in Society discussions, and she was quite wonderful. She was talking about charity and philanthropy, and she said that she doesn't believe in philanthropy or charity, but in a world that creates real opportunities for everybody to thrive, in the current context of, the racial problems that we had in the last few months. A lot has been discussed about systemic racism and how there are some systems in place that prevent some people from really having opportunities. So I wonder what your thoughts are about that, about charity and philanthropy. Thank you.
Yes, thanks. I've thought a lot about this, and you know, much of my searching as a person that wants to kind of move from a personal to sort of an extra personal orientation comes out in the form of how can I help? You know, how can I help? And yeah, I mean, I think it's very easy to think about writing a check towards an organization that you see doing good work. It's a lot harder to make that fundamental change within systems. And she's right. I mean, there are some systematic exclusive organizations that have a tremendous amount of influence. And I've found my way into many such systems. And they scale up to a size where, you know, it's sometimes dizzying to kind of easy to be overwhelmed with them, and feel powerless to change them. But when you read a resume or when take a person who's struggling and help them become successful, like in their jobs, it's like that organic, like personal intimate work is always there. And we have limited visibility into anything we're not intimately involved with. I work for a large corporation. I think I practice right livelihood, but my corporation isn't in Canada's list of socially responsible investments. it's excluded specifically for, I think, the carcinogens in baby powder. I'd have to look at the details of that. I looked at this earlier this year. But Teresa, you know, I support an engaged kind of practice. I think that, you know, the systems that we live within are unavoidable. I said, you know, I think in a previous talk, someone asked me like what I dream about. And I do dream of being a hermit, but I just can't make that jump yet. So in the like interim, while I still have to be in the world working actively, I want to be as all in as possible with the systems that I can help influence positively. Thank you.
Dave?
Thank you for your talk, Travis. I wanted to go back to something you mentioned about the impact of algorithms and technology and the internet. I heard something recently that really caught my attention. Somebody was talking about this impact over the last few decades and said, well, you know, if you look back in history, every time there's been a new technology for producing and consuming and conveying information and learning, there's been social disruption that followed in its wake. And specific examples that were pointed out included the printing press. I didn't realize that there was such chaos created in Europe for quite an extended period of time after the printing press was invented. And in fact, going back to the Greeks and how many of the Greeks were originally quite resistant to the notion of writing things down because they were so attached to oral traditions and thought that the youth were going to be ruined by the use of reading and writing. So, I mean, that on the one hand, sort of the attempt there was to give some sort of, you know, perspective and maybe, you know, the world will get used to having the internet and so forth. But on the other hand, things are changing so fast now that maybe the recovery period that was required after the printing press and the invention of writing and those other things, maybe we won't have time for that. By the time we get to where we would have recovered, we'll already have moved on to the next even bigger change. So I'm wondering how you see that playing out compared with what's happened historically in that regard.
Yeah, I think that printing was an explosion. I also think in classic times, like just widespread literacy was also like a huge accelerator of cultural change. So, you know, I don't think Christianity would have been what it was if it didn't have the combination of a, you know, middle class that was literate and traveling through like a late stage empire. But then, yeah, the Gutenberg Bible was like the first bestseller and popularized religion in Europe. And the information can be destabilizing. I think the explosion of like thinking about other people in Europe as a function of reading novels, like this sort of growth of empathy after about 1700 is like more and more like fiction was written, popular fiction, Shakespeare and then others, going from that sort of oral tradition to the written tradition. But I think we're meeting tonight through Zoom. It's kind of a filter that I certainly feel like an acute loss of not being with people physically. And I know it's changed my brain actually, right? In the last 6 months or so, my habits have been disrupted. And I've read some things about how, you know, in many ways, like this is a shift that it will go back to the way it was, but it won't entirely go back to the way it was because there are efficiencies that that will carry through and sort of be like a permanent like change, like working remotely, like certain kinds of outsourcing. Whether we're getting more virtual or not, as a result, I know that like, you know, working manual work, working with my hands, looking off into the distance, activities where I'm more in my body are healthy. They're like healthy for me as a organism. I just think that with the internet and the constant access of almost every imaginable like piece of information at like a search away, it becomes clear that like we, you know, as humans, it's like I've never felt a time, Dave, where like my intellect stood alone so much. Like I think about those old pictures of astronauts. You remember like the stock photos of the astronauts, and they'll always be in their suits, and you know, they'll have the American flag to the right. And then they have those huge fishbowl helmets, and they always have them cradled in their right arms, and they're smiling, and, you know, their heads are always very small, like in proportion to these big spacesuits. And I have felt like in this time, but not just as a shutdown, but as this like 20 years of like trying to move along in a technical career, that my head has sort of been like that big helmet. And that, you know, in this time of having like more time alone and having more time to contemplate like what we do, you know, when we go to work, that like my truer self is like much smaller than that and much more natural than that. Holding the intellect gently is always something that I struggle with.
Amen to that.
Does anybody else have a question? I am helping today with questions. Bonnie asked me to do that.
Hi, this is Dan. I don't have a video on, but I do have a question or a comment. Hi, Teresa. Yes.
Hi, we can hear you.
Hi, Dan.
Great. Hi, Travis. Good conversation. About 2 months ago, there's a really kindly psychiatrist who lives near me, and he works night shifts with homeless people during the COVID crisis and works with adolescent kids with issues. And I think highly of him. And I passed him on the street and I said, "Hey, how are you doing?" Meaning like, how you doing with all the crap going on in this COVID world? And he said, "Oh, well, actually, I like it better." And it floored me. I mean, I had no idea what he was talking about. And it wasn't what I expected. And he said, "Yeah," he said, "you know, I can meet with patients and like be at home with my wife and we have some nice time together. And, you know, I do things a whole lot differently, but I actually have a little more time to myself and no traffic." And it was, and it kind of blew my mind. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice to think like him? And actually I tried thinking like him, and it worked somewhat, but I think this point about immersions are, you know, a really good one. Actually, there's a lot of good points. The issue about philanthropy and its meaningfulness, and I mean, how can you come on any one side of any of these issues? I mean, I just, every time I go on one side, I find myself thinking about the other, you know? And I just, this issue of immersion, it's something that I've been struggling and living with for years, and it's immersion in this culture, and it's painful. At the same time, I can't leave it. This is what I live in, you know, this is where I live, my family, this is my life. And actually, if I look back at my dad, I don't think I'm any worse a person for it than my dad was. In many ways, I'm better. And so, sure. You know, I don't know how to measure it. It's crazy world and it's crazy making, and I don't sleep that well sometimes, you know, yeah. But at the same time, it's what I got, you know? And so I question it every moment of the day, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It's kind of a drag, but at the same time, it's what I got, you know, and the questions are really important to ask. And I don't have I have my beliefs, but I don't really talk about them too much because they change all the time depending on the situation, because I can see the Trumpist and I can understand what they're thinking, and, you know, and I don't like it and I don't want it, but, you know, there's a mindset there and a whole set of circumstances. And then I, you know, and all of that. And if either I'm really wishy-washy or I'm completely enlightened and I don't know it, but you know, that's kind of where I am. I'm just like, these are great issues and I don't have answers.
Right.
Yeah. But I love what that psychiatrist said. It kind of got me and really made me, it sort of turned my world around, at least for that moment that morning.
I felt that way for the first probably 2 months. Is that, do you think that's accurate, Rhea? Yeah. I mean, until about June, I think I was like, wow, this is, I can do things I was never able to do before. And, you know, I think what eventually caught up with me was, I'm in a role where my meeting schedule exploded. So like, you know, I usually would have like 2 or 3 hours of meetings a day, but they weren't all like on the computer. And that doubled. That was one thing. And then like I became increasingly disconnected from what I create, which is hardware. And at first I had a good memory of what the hardware was, so I could still work on it. But then like I would forget, and I would have more and more of an abstract idea of what it was that I was working on. And then, you know, the last thing, Dan, is I just got lonely. I got lonely not seeing people, and physically seeing people is like, it's important to me. Like it's different than, you know, a phone call or even Zoom.
Yeah.
And I felt it like physically, like a physical loneliness, not just like a more of a mental one. Because I could like go in, I'm in work, more, and, you know, some of the people I work with, you know, they'll just microwave pop, you know, some popcorn and eat it together. And it's like, you can just see they're giddy. They're so happy to see other people. So, I mean, I think sociability is like varies, you know, of course. And, you know, sounds like your friend has a life and a routine that works for him. Mm-hmm. I miss seeing folks in the Zendo. And you know, I think that it'll make it sweeter. This could be one of those, if you ever heard of those anti-fragile events where it's, you know, like it's a shock, but we come back and we've grown from this, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have the feelings of loneliness and so forth. But I also just think of the issues that you were talking about philanthropy. I mean, all of these things are, they're huge issues, and the digitization is huge. And I work at a company that does digital services, and, mm-hmm. And in it, I see human beings being human also. And so it's it continues to be a dance.
Yeah. And you know, when we're disrupted from our schedules, like it is a time to reflect and to think about what can we do with the the organizations we care about. And so I think, charity or philanthropy is one of those things, right? Like we can think about, we can research it. Mm-hmm. We can talk, as a group. And I really, again, I was talking about democratic values, but I really like, and I didn't mention this, but I'm really like, I try to work pragmatically with people, like, you know, like hearing people out is something I enjoy. You know, ultimately organizations have to make decisions. But that sort of messy, like dialogue, you know, is something that I enjoy doing. And when there's a purpose, a collective purpose, I feel good. So, you know, I think we've got a very like tight knit sangha. But we don't have the normal like routines, and so there are alternatives in this interim, and I think that, you know, thinking about giving is one of them.
Yeah. Thanks for everyone's time.
Thanks, Dan.
Any other comments or questions, Vanessa?
Thank you. I have a second question if somebody else doesn't have another question. At one point in your talk, you were talking about algorithms that rule the world. I was wondering if you could say something more specifically, like give some examples, like what you mean specifically.
Well, it's the digital systems that we use right now. We're using them, and they're so ubiquitous that we don't stop to think about the differences between, picking up a e-reader and gardening. In fact, you could be, in your garden and have a choice of, doing something that connects you to this vast amount of information. And by algorithms, I also mean that the intent of so much of the information we get is also on some level commerce. It is on some level it's information sharing. On some level it's about selling something. And it may not even be financial. It might be to ally yourself with a group. So there's a form of selection filtering that's happening. And it's stunning to me when I go into certain, websites, like I think we're all familiar with YouTube. Recommendations that it gives you are so like how does it know that I am interested in this? And that can be the most delightful thing, actually, right? I'm not saying that, but to the earlier part of the conversation with Dave, it's I can remember buying CDs for $15 a piece, and that was a lot of money for me. And I still have those CDs. I can't let go of them, right? And it meant something for me to have that music. At the same time, it's when you have everything informationally to take care of your life and to take care of, some of the more humble parts of your life, I think it can become more challenging. I'm sure this isn't surprising to anyone, but it's all very obvious. And I acknowledge that this is a very general talk about values. But I think what I see is actually a world right now that is looking at the United States, and within the United States, we have two sets of, partial populace. The candidates, they really they're elites, but their rhetoric is populist, but it's a partial populism. And the bubbles around both of the groups mean that they talk selectively about their preferred values. And the information that's allowed into these groups is filtered by digital systems. And that's really scary to me. It's only by doing a lot of work or going outside of your preferred inclusive group that you start to realize that there's other values and other priorities that you really have to consider, and that people actually have much more legitimate concerns than what you would read in, on the web or see on, TV. So the populism I'm talking about is the populism that includes everyone. And that might not sell. It might be much more difficult. I was talking with someone from Canando over the weekend. And when I talked about this divide between, the polarized groups within the United States, he said, well, that's a mountain. That is a mountain of misunderstanding.
Casey, do you have a question?
I can have a comment. Maybe question. So over the weekend, I participated in the Buddhist election retreat. And I guess unexpectedly, I came away with a sense of community and purposefulness. I didn't really expect that because my past experience with get out the vote efforts has been kind of draining and frazzled. But it was a 4.5 hour thing. And midway, just felt a grounding and like calmness and felt really still. I was sharing with Bonnie. And by the end, I came away with a sense of well-being. It's pretty much reminiscent of a half a day sashimi.
Yeah.
That's how powerful it was. I really didn't anticipate that. So anyway, the facilitators reported that we got, after 2 half-day writing retreats, we got 25,000 letters out. That's pretty amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, that was very encouraging. And they're part of a larger group. And the larger group together have 13.5 million. They reach 13.5 million swing voters in 6 swing states. So it's still ongoing. Bonnie has more information if anybody wants to give it a go. Maybe, you know, we had like a Dharma talk and meditation periods that probably helped, you know, with the entire tone of things.
Yeah, it sounds like you had a deliberate schedule. Like you had time to, did you have time to be outside also?
No. But I guess it was much better paced than when I did that kind of thing on my own. You know, I always felt like I have to do more. But it was well paced, so I felt like whatever I did was just right.
I'm glad to hear that. That was a positive experience for you. Thank you.
Any last questions? All right. I think we are done for tonight. Thank you, Travis.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.